Good day. What about you?
Kind of a surprise to see you come into the studio tonight.
Yeah, well, I need to talk to you about something, but let's order first.
We studied the sushi list together, and Kendall checked off 3 different variations on spicy tuna, while I went with California and cucumber rolls. Before the election, I had started taking my daughter to Katsuya as her palate grew sophisticated, and Wednesday night pancakes stopped being an attraction. Of course, my food interests were stunted compared to hers, and I could never wrap my mind around the idea of uncooked fish. But there were always plenty of other things to eat for the non-adventurous. Sake was another story. Hot or cold, I liked it. I was into my 3rd cup by the time one of the sushi chefs finally leaned over and took our order. I think the quick draw on the drink was in part due to my reason for being there, and the conversation I felt obligated to have with Kendall. "So what's up?" she said after expertly using a pair of chopsticks to sample the cucumber salad I had previously ordered.
"This is like last night. You didn't have to come all the way out to see me."
"No, I wanted to see you," I said. "But I also need to talk to you more about this case with Moya and Marco, the DEA agent." She frowned.
"Please don't tell me I have to go there and talk to that lawyer."
"No, nothing like that. There's no depot, and I'll make sure it stays that way. But something else came up today." I paused, as I still had not formulated how I wanted to approach her with this.
"Well, what is it?" she prompted.
"The case is kind of dicey because of the people involved. You've got Moya up there in prison, and then you have Marco, the DEA agent, down here trying to protect himself and his cases. And in the middle of this, you have what happened to Gloria and then my client, who they charged with her killing, but I don't think did it. So a lot of moving parts in this, and then this morning, I found out that there's a tracker on my car."
"What do you mean? What's a tracker?"
"Like a GPS thing. It means somebody's tracking me. They know what moves I'm making, at least by car." I turned on my stool so I could look at her and directly see how she took this information. I could see the significance of it didn't register to her. "I don't know how long the device has been on there," I said, "but I went to your house twice yesterday, first with Earl and then last night by myself." Now it started to register. I saw the first inkling of fear move into her eyes.
"What does this mean? Somebody's going to come to my house?"
"No, I don't think it means that. There's no reason to panic. But I thought you should know."
"Who put it there?"
"We're not 100% sure, but we think it was the DEA agent, Marco." At this inopportune moment, the sushi chef lifted a large leaf-shaped plate over the counter and put it down in front of us. 5 sliced rolls were displayed beautifully with pickled ginger and the hot wasabi paste that my daughter called Green Death. I nodded my thanks to the chef, and Kendall just stared at the food while considering what I just told her. "I debated whether to even tell you," I said, "but I thought you should know. Tonight I took precautions. I walked down the hill from my house and caught a cab. They won't know I'm with you. My car is sitting in front of my house."
"How do you know you're not being followed too?"
"I've had people working on that all day. It looks like it's just the electronic tracker." If that brought any measure of comfort to her, she didn't show it.
"Can't you just take it off and get rid of it?" she asked.
"That's an option," I said, nodding. "But there are other options. We might be able to use it against them. You know, feed them information that will be confusing or wrong. We're still thinking about it, so for now it's still on there.
Why don't you eat some of this?" "I'm not sure I'm hungry anymore."
"Come on, you worked hard all day. You said you were starving." Reluctantly, she poured a dollop of soy sauce into one of the small dishes and mixed in a dab of wasabi paste. She then dipped a slice of one of the tuna rolls and ate it. She liked it and immediately sampled another. I was useless with chopsticks, so I used my fingers to take a slice of California roll. I skipped the wasabi. 2 bites later, and I was back to business. "Kendall, I know I asked you this yesterday, but I need to do it again. This DEA agent, James Marco, are you sure you never had dealings with him? He's a dark-haired guy, about 40 now, has a mustache, mean eyes. If he's DEA, you don't have to describe him. I never had any dealings with the DEA. I nodded. Okay, and you can't think of any reason you might be on his radar in regard to Gloria Dayton, right?
No, no reason.
You told me yesterday that one of the services you provided was to bring cocaine. Gloria and Trina got theirs from Moya. Where did you get yours? Kendall slowly finished the piece of California roll she was eating and then put her chopsticks down on the little stand next to her plate. I really don't like talking about this, she said. I think you brought me here so I would feel cornered and have to answer.
No,
I said quickly. That's not true, and I don't want you to feel cornered. I'm sorry if I'm pushing this too far. I just want to be sure you're in the clear, that's all. She wiped her mouth with her napkin. I had a feeling that dinner was over. I need to go to the restroom, she said. Okay, I said. I stood up and pushed my stool back so she would have room for egress. Are you coming back? I asked. Yes, I'll be back, she said curtly. I sat back down and watched her as she made her way to the hallway in the back. I knew she could leave through a rear door, and I wouldn't know it for 10 minutes. But I had faith. I pulled out my phone to see if my daughter had answered my text, but she hadn't. I thought about texting her again, maybe sending her a photo of the California roll from Katsuya, but decided not to push it. Kendall returned in less than 5 minutes and slid silently back onto her stool. Before I could speak, she made a statement that she had apparently worked out in the restroom. I got the product that I brought to clients from Hector Moya, but it was indirectly from him. I bought it from Gloria and Trina at their cost. I never once met their dealer or crossed paths with a DEA agent while I was in that life. It's something I've left behind, and I don't want to have to talk about it with you or anybody else again. That's perfectly fine, Kendall. When you asked me to dinner, I was very happy. I thought it was for a different reason, and I was excited. So that's why I reacted the way I did when you asked about the drugs. I'm sorry I messed things up. But believe me, I was excited too when you said you would meet me. So why don't we forget about all the work stuff and eat some sushi? I gestured toward the platter. Most of our order was still there. She smiled tentatively and nodded. I smiled back. Then we need more sake, I said. Chapter 25. On the way back home, I decided to let the cab take me all the way to my door. I was tired from the work and news of the day and the hike up the trail at Fryman Canyon. I figured even if someone was watching my house and car, he would only be able to puzzle over where I'd been for the last 4 hours. I paid the fare, got out, and climbed the stairs to the front door. At the top, I paused to look out across the iridescent landscape. It was a clear night, and I could see all the way to the lighted towers in Century City. It reminded me that somewhere near those towers in the lowlands was where Sly Fulgoni Jr. made his pitiful stand in the land of law. I turned and looked over my other shoulder toward downtown. Farther away, the lights seemed less vibrant, having to fight their way through the smog. I could, however, see the glow of lights from Chavez Ravine, a home game for the Dodgers, who had started the season abysmally. I opened the door and went in. I was tempted to put on the radio and listen to the ageless Vin Scully call the game, but I was too tired. I went to the kitchen to get a bottle of water, pausing for a moment to look at the postcard from Hawaii on the fridge. I then went directly to my bedroom to crash. 2 hours later, I was on a black horse galloping out of control across a dark landscape, lit only by cracks of lightning, when my phone woke me. I was in bed, still fully clothed. I stared at the ceiling, trying to remember the dream when the phone rang again. I reached into my pocket for it and answered without looking at the display. For some reason, I expected it to be my daughter, and a tone of desperation infected my hello.
Holler?
Yes, who is this?
Sly Fulgoni, are you all right?
The deep timbre in the voice told me I was talking to Sly Sr., calling in from Victorville again. I'm fine. How'd you get this number?
Valenzuela gave it to me. He doesn't like you too much, Holler. Something about unfulfilled promises.
I sat up on the side of the bed and looked at the clock. It was 2:10.
Yeah, well, fuck him, I said.
Why are you calling me, Sly? I'm coming up to see you tomorrow.
Yeah, not so fast, smart guy. I don't like you threatening me, or my son for that matter. So we need to get a few things straight before you make the long drive up here.
Hold on. I put the phone down on the bed and turned on the bed lamp. I opened the bottle of water I'd retrieved before going to sleep and drank almost half of it down. It helped clear my head. I then picked up the phone again.
You there, Sly? Where else am I gonna go?
Right.
So what things do we need to straighten out? First of all, this co-counsel bullshit you laid on young Sly. Not going to fly, Holler. Moya's ours, and we're not sharing.
Have you really thought this out?
What's to think out? We've got it covered.
Sly, you're in prison. It's going to reach a point where the paper on this is finished, and somebody's got to go to court. And do you really think young Sly is going to walk into federal court, go up against government lawyers and the DEA, and not have his head handed to him? There was no immediate answer, so I pressed it further.
I'm a father too, Sly, and we all love our kids. But young Sly is working off the scripts you provide him right now. There is no script when you get into a courtroom. It's do or die.
Still no response. I didn't have an appointment when I dropped by the office today. I don't know exactly what he was doing, but it wasn't lawyer work. He's got nothing on the calendar, Sly. He's got no experience, and he can't even answer questions about this case. Those depots you want scheduled for next week? My guess is he'll get the questions, every question, from you.
Not true. That's not true.
His first objection to anything I had been saying.
All right, so he'll write some of his own questions. It's still your depot, and you know it.
Look, Sly, you've got a credible cause of action here.
I think this could work, but not unless you've got somebody going in there who knows his way around a habeas hearing. How much you want?
This time I paused. I knew that I had him and was about to close the deal.
You're talking about money? I don't want any money. I want cooperation on my guy. We share information and we share Moya. I may need him on my case.
He didn't respond. He was thinking. I decided to jump in with my closing argument.
Speaking of Moya, you really want him sitting next to young Sly if this thing goes the wrong way in court? You want him looking at your son when he wants someone to blame after a judge sends him back to Victorville for the rest of his life?
I heard some stories today about Moya back in his Sinaloa days. He's not the kind of guy you want near your son when things turn south.
Who told you those stories?
Agent Marco did. He visited me, just like I'm sure he visited young Sly. Sly Sr. didn't respond, but this time I didn't interrupt the silence. I'd said all I had to say. Now I waited, but it didn't take long.
When will you get here?
Sly Sr. asked.
Well, it's the middle of the night.
I'm going to go back to sleep now and sleep late, maybe 8 o'clock, and then I'll head up there. I'll process in when I get there, maybe get in to see you before lunch.
Lunch around here is 10:30. I used to have a 1 o'clock table every day at Water Grill.
I nodded. The little things are missed most.
Okay, then I'll see you after lunch. First you, then Moya. You remind him that this time I'm on his side, okay?
Okay. See you then. I disconnected the call and switched over to the message app. My daughter had still not responded to the message I had sent her almost 6 hours before. I set the alarm on the phone for 7 and put it on the nightstand. I stripped off my clothes and this time got under the covers. I lay on my back, thinking about things. My daughter, then Kendall. She had kissed me again when we'd separated outside the door of Katsuya. I felt as though things were changing in me, as though I was closing one door and opening another. It made me sad and hopeful at the same time. Before drifting off, I remembered the black horse racing across the field of lightning. I had been holding onto its neck because there were no reins. I remembered holding fast and hanging on for dear life. Chapter 26. I came down the front stairs at exactly 8 and found Earl Briggs waiting, leaning against his car parked out front and taking in the view of West Hollywood past the shoulders of Laurel Canyon. "Morning, Earl," I said. He took the 2 Starbucks cups off the hood of his car and crossed the street to the Lincoln. I exchanged the keys for 1 of the cups and thanked him for thinking of stopping for coffee before we headed off. The Lincoln had gotten a clean sweep by Cisco the afternoon before. The GPS tracker was still in place, but he and his men had found no bugs or cameras on the vehicle. We headed south to pick up the 10 freeway east, stopping only to top off the Lincoln's big gas tank. Traffic was grim, but I knew it would thin out once we got past downtown and turned north on the 15. From there, it was a straight shot north through the Mojave. Overnight, Jennifer had sent me several emails with documents from her research attached. I passed the time by reading through these. The first thing to catch my eye was her analysis of Hector Moya's habeas petition and what was riding on it. Moya had already been incarcerated for 8 years since his arrest. The life term he received because of the gun enhancement under the federal career criminal statute was the only thing currently keeping him behind bars. He was sentenced to 6 years for the cocaine found in his possession. The life term was added on top of that. This meant that Moya's immediate freedom was riding on the outcome of his habeas petition. To me, it was an added reason for him to cooperate with me on the Lacoste case and to put his future in more experienced hands than those of Sylvester Fulgoni Jr. This knowledge also put Marco's visit with me the day before in better perspective. The DEA agent had to have known as he sat across from me in the Lincoln that a violent man he had put away presumably for life could see freedom soon, depending upon the outcome of a couple of court cases he could not control. I next reviewed the transcript from Hector Moya's trial 7 years before. I read 2 sections, one containing the testimony of an officer with the LAPD warrant enforcement team, and the other containing part of the testimony of DEA agent James Marco. The LAPD cop testified about Moya's arrest and his finding the gun hidden under the mattress in the hotel room. The testimony from Marco contained replies to questioning about the analysis and trace work that was done on the recovered firearm. It was key testimony because it tied the gun to Moya through a purchase in Nogales, Arizona. About the time we came through the mountains into the Mojave, I grew tired of the reading work and told Earl to wake me when we got there. I then racked out across the back seat and closed my eyes. I'd had a restless sleep after my middle-of-the-night conversation with Sly Fulgoni Sr. and needed to catch up. I knew from prior experience that going into a prison would be exhausting. It was an ordeal that fully taxed the senses. Prison sounds and smells, the drab gray steel set off by the garish orange uniforms of the incarcerated, the mixture of desperation and threat in the faces of the men I'd come to visit. It was not a place I ever wanted to spend an extra minute in. It always felt as if I were holding my breath the whole time I was inside. Despite the cramped configuration of the back seat, I managed to doze off for almost a half hour. Earl woke me on our approach to the prison. I checked my phone and saw that we had made good time despite the early traffic. It was only 10 o'clock, and that was when attorney visiting hours began.
"You don't mind, boss. I'm going to wait outside on this one," Earl said.
I smiled at him in the mirror. "I don't mind, Earl. I wish I could, too." I handed him my phone over the seat. There was no way I would be allowed to take it inside, which was ironic since most of the prisoners had access to cell phones. "If Cisco, Lorna, or Bullock's calls, answer it and tell them I'm inside. Everything else, let go to message."
"You got it."
He dropped me at the main visitor's entrance. The process of getting in to see Fulgoni and Moya went smoothly. I had to show a driver's license and my California bar card, then sign one document certifying that I was an attorney, and a second certifying that I was not smuggling drugs or other illegal contraband into the facility. After that, I was walked through a magnetometer after removing my belt and shoes. I was placed in an attorney-client room and given an electronic alert to clip to my belt. If I was physically threatened by my client, I was instructed to yank the pager-sized device off my belt, and an alarm would sound, drawing guards to the room. Of course, I would still need to be alive to pull it, but that detail wasn't mentioned. This had all come about because of one court ruling or another that had prohibited guards from watching over attorney-client meetings in the prison. I was left alone in the 10x10 room to wait. There was a table and two chairs and an electronic call box on the wall next to the door. The waiting was a given. I don't think I had ever made a prison visit where I walked into the interview room and my client was there waiting for me. It was routine for attorneys to stack interviews with multiple clients at a prison, even when the cases were unrelated. It saved travel and clearance time to get it all done in one visit. But usually, the prisoners were brought in on a timetable that suited the prison staff and was based on the schedules and availability of the prisoners. I had asked the visitor center captain to allow me to visit with Fulgoni first and then Moya. He frowned at the request, but said he would see what he could do. Maybe that was why the wait seemed extraordinarily long. 30 minutes went by before Fulgoni was finally brought into the interview room. At first, I almost told the guards escorting him that he had the wrong guy, but then I realized it was indeed Sylvester Fulgoni Sr. Though I'd finally recognized him, he still wasn't the man I recalled from the courthouses and courtrooms we both worked at one time. The man shuffling into the room in leg chains was pale and haggard, hunched over, and for the first time, I realized he must have worn a toupee all those years I knew of him in L.A. No such vanity was allowed in prison. The crown of his head was bald and sharply reflected the overhead fluorescent lights. He took a seat across the table from me. His wrists were cuffed to a waist chain. We didn't shake hands. "Hello, Sly," I said. "How is lunch?" "Lunch was the same as it is every day here. Bologna on white bread, unfit for human consumption." "I'm sorry to hear that." "I'm not. I figure when I start liking it, then I've got a problem." I nodded. "I get that. I don't know about you, but back in the day, I had clients who liked to hide out in prison. Places like this. It was easier than the streets because you got your three squares, a bed, clean laundry, sex and drugs readily available if you want them. It was dangerous, but the streets were plenty dangerous too." "Yeah, I've had a few like that." "Well, that's not me. I consider this place to be a living hell on earth." "But less than a year to go, right?" 341 days. I used to be able to tell it down to the hour and minute, but I'm a little more relaxed about that now." I nodded again, and decided that was enough as far as the pleasantries went. It was time to get down to business. I hadn't driven all the way up to discuss the pros and cons of prison life, or to figuratively pat Sylvester Fulgoni on the back. "Did you talk to Hector Moya about me this morning?" Fulgoni nodded. "That I did, and you're all set. He'll take the meeting and he'll take you as co-counsel with young Sly." "Good. I can't say he's too happy about it. He's pretty convinced that you're in part responsible for him being here." Before I could say a word in my defense, there was a booming impact that shook the room and, I assumed, the entire prison. My hand went to my belt, and the alarm, as my first thought, was that there was some kind of explosion and prison break occurring. Then I noticed that Fulgoni hadn't even flinched and had a glib smile on his face. "That was a big one," he said calmly. "They probably have the B-2 up today, the stealth." Of course, I now remembered the nearby airbase. I tried to shake it off and get back to business. My legal pad was on the table in front of me. I had jotted down a few questions and reminders while I waited for Fulgoni. I wanted to start with the basics and lead up to the important questions once I had Fulgoni vested in the conversation. Tell me about Moya. I want to know how and when this whole thing started.
Well, as far as I know, I'm one of two defrocked lawyers in here. The other guy was part of a bank fraud in San Diego. Anyway, it kind of gets known what you did in the world and people come to you. First, it's general advice and recommendations. Then some come because they want help with a writ. I'm talking about guys in here long enough to be abandoned by their lawyers because they've exhausted their appeals. Guys who don't want to give up.
Okay. Well, Hector was one of those guys. He came to me, said the government hadn't played fair, and wanted to know what he could still do about it. The thing is, nobody had ever believed him. His own attorneys didn't believe his story, and didn't even put an investigator on it, as far as I could tell.
You're talking about the DEA planting the gun in his room to get the enhancement?
Yeah, the enhancement that puts him in here for life. I'm not talking about the powder in his room. He totally cops to that. But he said the gun wasn't his. And it turns out, he's been saying that since day one, but nobody would listen.
Well, I listened. I mean, what else am I going to do in here but listen to people?
Okay. So that's your start. My son filed the paper, and here we are.
But let's go back to before young Sly filed the habeas petition. Let's go back to last year. See, I'm trying to put all of this together. Moya tells you the gun was planted. Did he tell you Gloria Dayton planted it?
No, he said the cops did it. He was arrested by the LAPD after you made the deal with the DA's office. Remember that? Only he didn't know about any deal until years later, until I told him. All he knew at the time was that the LAPD came through his door with a felony fugitive warrant. They found the coke in the bureau and the firearm under the mattress, and that was it. The fugitive beef was for a grand jury no-show. That was nothing compared to the case they had now. He had 2 ounces of blow in the room and the gun. And then the Fed swooped in and scooped the whole thing up, and he goes to trial in federal court, where they have the Lifetime Achievement Award. Convenient, huh?
Yeah, and I know all of that. I'm talking about the gun. I'm trying to track down how you went from his story to Gloria Dayton. Your habeas petition says Gloria planted the gun.
It was simple. I asked the right questions, and then I took 2 steps back and looked at the big picture. I came at it from the angle of believing Hector Moya. Like I said, nobody had before. But he came to me and said, yes, the powder in that room was mine and I'll do the time for it, but not the gun. I figured, why deny one and not the other unless you're telling the truth?
I could think of reasons to do exactly that, lie about one thing and not the other, but I kept them to myself for now.
So, Gloria.
Right, Gloria. Hector said the gun was a plant.
Well, I had a case once with a firearm enhancement attached. Same thing. But this was a DEA case from the start. No locals. A straight DEA buy bust. And the client swore to me he had no gun on him when the deal went down. I didn't believe him at first. I mean, who goes to buy a kilo with 25K in a briefcase and no gun for backup? But then I started looking into it.
You proved the gun was planted to get the enhancement.
Fulgoni frowned and shook his head.
Actually, I was never able to prove it, and my guy went down for it. But the unit that made the bus was something called the Interagency Cartel Enforcement Team, which was run by the DEA and headed up by an agent named Jimmy Marco. He's the same guy who did the swoop and scoop on Moya. So when that name came up in the file, I thought there was something to it. You know, that was twice I'd seen this on a case with his name on it. I figured, where there's smoke, there might be fire.
I thought for a long moment, trying to put the pieces together and understand the moves Fulgoni had made.
You had the name Marco, but he didn't come into it until after the arrest went down and the locals had found the coke and the gun, I said in summary. So if Marco was behind this,
then you had to figure out how he got the gun in there for the locals to find. Falcone nodded. Exactly. So I went to Hector and said, what if the gun wasn't planted by the locals? What if it was already there, under the mattress, and planted earlier by somebody else? Who was in that room between the time you checked into that hotel and the bus went down? That was 4 days, and I asked him for a list with the names of everybody who'd visited that room in that time frame. Gloria Dayton. Yes, we zeroed in on her. But she wasn't the only one who had been in that room. There had been at least one other hooker, Hector's brother, and a couple other associates, too. Luckily, we didn't have to vet the housekeepers because Hector kept the do not disturb on his door the whole time. But we zeroed in on Gloria because I had a friend run all the names through the police computer and bingo! She happened to get popped one frickin' day before they took Hector down. I nodded. The logic made sense. I would have zeroed in on Gloria as well. I also knew what I would have done next. How'd you track down Gloria? She changed her name, she moved away, and then moved back. The internet. These girls can change names, locations, doesn't matter. The business is based on the visual. Young Sly got her booking photo from 8 years ago, when she got arrested on a possession and prostitution beef, and then he went online, checking photos on escort sites. Eventually, he found her. She'd changed her hair, but that was about it. He printed out photos and brought them up here. Hector confirmed. I was surprised. Sly Jr. had actually done something that created a significant break in the case. And then you, of course, had Jr. paper her. I said it like the next move had been a matter of routine. Yeah, we hit her with a subpoena. We wanted to bring her in to put her on the record. Who is the process server, Valenzuela? I don't know. Somebody Sly Jr. hired. I leaned across the table and started increasing the urgency and momentum, hitting him with the questions without pause. Was she photographed to prove receipt? Falcone shrugged like he didn't know and didn't care. Was she? Look, I don't know. I was up here, Holler. What's so? If there's a photo, I want it. Tell your son. Fine, okay. When did you paper her? I don't know the date. Last year sometime. Obviously before she got killed by her pimp. I leaned further across the table. How long before she got killed? About a week, I think. I hammered my fist down on the table. She wasn't killed by her pimp. I pointed across the table at him. You got her killed. You and your son. They found out about the subpoena. They couldn't trust that she wouldn't talk. Falcone was shaking his head before I was finished. First of all, who is they? Marco, the ICE team. Do you think they would risk this coming out? Especially if planting firearms was common practice with that team. Think of all the reputations, careers, and cases that would be jeopardized. You don't think that's motive for murder? You don't think they'd risk taking out a hooker if it meant securing their operation? Falcone held up a hand to stop me. Look, I'm not stupid, Holler. I knew the risks. The subpoena was filed under seal. Marco couldn't have known about it. So she ended up dead a week later and you thought, what, that the pimp did it and it was all just coincidence? I thought what the police thought and what my son read to me out of the newspaper. That her pimp killed her and we missed our chance to have her help Moya. I shook my head. Bullshit. You knew. You must have known you set things in motion. How many days before the deposition was she killed? I don't know. I didn't sked. That's bullshit. You knew. How many days? 4. But it doesn't matter. It was under seal. No one knew but her and us. I nodded. Yeah. Only you and she knew. And what did you expect? That she wouldn't tell someone who might tell somebody else? Or that she might not call up Jimmy Marco, who she used to snitch for, and say, what should I do about this? Suddenly I realized something that gave an answer to one of the questions I'd been carrying since handling the phony subpoena served on Kendall Roberts. I pointed at Falcone's chest. I know what it was. You thought Marco had somebody inside the clerk's office. Somebody who told him about the sealed subpoena. That's why your son dummied up the subpoena he had Valenzuela serve on Kendall Roberts. You two didn't want to do it again, get somebody killed. You wanted her to come in so Junior could find out what she knew about Gloria and Marco. But you were afraid a real subpoena would get back to Marco, even if it was under seal.
You don't know what you're talking about, Holler.
No, I know exactly what I'm talking about.
One way or another, your subpoena got Gloria killed. You both knew it, and you decided to keep quiet about it and lie low while some poor schmuck went away for it. You're way off base on this.
Really? I don't think so. Why the subpoenas this week? To me and Marco and the phony one to Kendall Roberts. Why now?
Because a petition was filed almost 6 months ago. We had to move on it or it would be dismissed. It had nothing to do with Gloria Dayton or...
That's such bullshit.
And you know something, Sly? You and your son are no better than Marco and Langford in all of this.
Falcone stood up.
First of all, I don't know who Langford is. And second, we're done here. And you can forget about Moya. He's ours, not yours. You're not seeing him.
He turned and started shuffling toward the door. Sit down, Sly. We're not finished, I said to his back. You walk out of here and the state bar is going to come down all over you and Junior. You're not an attorney anymore, Sly. You are operating a writ mill in here and feeding cases to a kid who sits in an office in a Dodgers jersey and doesn't know the first thing about being a lawyer. The bar will tear him up and throw him away. You want that for him? For you? Who will you feed cases to when Junior's out of business?
Falcone turned around and kicked at the door with his heel to alert the guard.
What's it gonna be, Sly? I asked. The guard opened the door. Falcone glanced back at him, hesitated, and then said he needed 5 more minutes. The door was closed, and Falcone looked at me.
You threatened my son yesterday, but I didn't think you'd have the balls to threaten me.
It's not a threat, Sly. I'll shut you both down.
You're an asshole, Holler.
I nodded.
Yeah, I'm an asshole. When I've got an innocent man facing a murder count.
He had nothing to say to that.
Sit back down, I instructed. You're going to tell me how to handle Hector Moya.
Chapter 27. The wait between interviews with Falcone and Moya was 25 minutes and 2 more teeth-rattling sonic booms. When the door finally opened, Moya stepped in calmly and slowly, his eyes steady on me. He walked with a grace and ease that belied his situation, and even suggested that the 2 men behind him were personal valets, not prison guards. His orange jumpsuit was vibrant and had crisp creases. Falcone's had been faded from 1,000 washes and frayed at the edges of the sleeves. Moya was taller and more muscled than I had expected. Younger, too. I put him at 35 tops. He had wide shoulders at the top of a torso that tapered down like a V. The sleeves of his jumpsuit stretched tightly against his biceps. I realized that despite my interaction with his case 8 years before, I had never seen him in person or in a newspaper photograph or television report. I had built a visual image based on fantasy. I had him as a small, round man who was venal and cruel and had gotten what he deserved. I wasn't expecting the specimen standing before me now. And this was a concern because, unlike Falcone, Moya was not chained at the ankles and waist. He was as unencumbered as I was. He accurately picked up my concern and addressed it before even sitting down.
I've been here much longer than Silvestri, he said. I am trusted and not chained like an animal.
He spoke with a strong accent but was clearly understandable. I nodded cautiously, not knowing whether his explanation contained some sort of threat.
Why don't you have a seat? I said.
Moya pulled back the chair and sat down. He crossed his legs and held his hands together in his lap. He immediately looked relaxed, as if meeting in a lawyer's office instead of a prison.
"You know," he said, "6 months ago, my plan was to have you killed in a very painful manner. When Silvestri spoke of the part you played in my case, I became very angry. I was upset, and I wanted you dead, Mr. Haller. Glory days, too."
I nodded, as though I was sympathetic to his situation. "Well, I'm glad that didn't happen, because I'm still here, and I may be able to help you." He shook his head. "The reason I tell you this is because only a fool would think I had no motive to have you and Gloria Dayton eliminated. But I did not do this. If I had, you and she would have simply disappeared. This is the way it is done. There would be no case and no trial of an innocent man." I nodded. "I understand. And I know it means little to you, but I also have to tell you that 8 years ago I was doing my job, which was to do my best in the defense of a client.
It does not matter. Your laws, your code. A snitch is a snitch, and in my business they disappear. Sometimes with their lawyers."
He stared coldly at me, through the darkest eyes I think I had ever seen, besides my own half-brother's. Then he broke away, and his voice changed as he engaged in the business of the day, the tone moving from dead-on threat to collegial cooperation.
"So, Mr. Haller, what must we discuss here today?"
"I want to talk about the gun that was found in your hotel room when you were arrested."
"It was not my gun. I have said this from the very beginning. No one has believed me."
"I wasn't there at the beginning, at least on your side, but I'm pretty sure I believe you now."
"And you'll do something about it."
"I'm going to try."
"Do you understand the stakes that are involved?"
"I understand that the people who did this to you will stop at nothing to keep their crimes secret, because I'm pretty sure you're not the only one they did it to. They already killed Gloria Dayton. So we will have to be very cautious until we can get this into open court. Once we are there, it will be harder for them to hide behind their badges and the cover of night. They'll have to come out and answer to us."
Moya nodded. "Gloria, she was important to you.
For a time. But what is important to me now is that I have a client in the county jail accused of killing her, and he didn't do it. I have to get him out, and I need you to help me. If you help me, I will certainly help you. That all right with you?"
"It is all right. I have people who can protect you."
I nodded. I expected that he might make such an offer, but it wasn't the kind of protection I was interested in. "I think I'm all right," I said. "I've got my own people. But I'll tell you what. I've got a client in the pink module at Men's Central down in L.A. You think you can get somebody in there to sort of watch over him? He's in there alone, and I'm worried they're going to see this thing moving toward a trial in which a lot of these secrets are going to come out. They'll know that the best way to avoid that is to avoid having a trial." Moya nodded.
"If there is no client, there is no trial," he said.
"You got that right," I said.
"Then I will see to it that he is protected."
"Thank you. And while you're at it, I'd double up on whatever protective measures you have for yourself in here."
"That will be done as well."
"Good. Now let's talk about the gun." I flipped a few pages back on my legal pad to get to the notes I had written off the trial transcript. I refreshed myself on the facts and then looked at Moya. "Okay, at your trial, the arresting officer from the LAPD described coming into the room and arresting you, and then finding the gun. Were you still in the room when they found it, or had you already been pulled out of there?" He nodded, as if to say he could answer this one.
"It was a two-room suite. They handcuff me and make me sit on the couch in the living room. A man with a gun stood over me while the others began to search through the room. They found the cocaine in a drawer in the bedroom. Then they said they found the gun. He come out of the bedroom and show me the gun in a plastic bag, and I said it was not my gun.
He said, "It is now."
I wrote a few notes down and spoke without looking up from the pad. "And he was the LAPD officer who testified at the trial, an officer named Robert Ramos?"
"That was him."
"You're sure he said, 'It is now,' when you said it wasn't your gun?" "That is what he said."
It was a good note to have.
It was hearsay, and therefore might not even be allowed as testimony in a trial. But if Moyle was telling the truth, and I believed he was, then it meant Ramos might have had some knowledge of the gun having been planted in the room. Maybe he had been coached to look under the mattress.
"There was no video of the search introduced at your trial. Do you recall seeing anybody with a video camera?"
"Yes, they take a video of me and the whole room. They humiliate me. They make me take off my clothes for the search, and the video man was there."
This made me curious. They had video, but didn't use it at trial. Why? What was on the video that made it a risk to show to a jury? The humiliation of Hector Moya? Possibly, but possibly something else. I made another note on my pad and then moved on to the next thing I wanted to cover. "Have you ever been in Nogales, Arizona?"
"No, never."
"You're sure? Never in your life?"
"Never."
According to Marco's testimony at trial, he received an ATF report tracing the gun. According to this report, the weapon was a .25 caliber Guardian manufactured by North American Arms. It was originally purchased in Colorado by a man named Budwin Dell, who then sold it at a gun show in Nogales 5 weeks before it was allegedly found in Moya's hotel room. Dell was not a federally licensed firearms dealer, so he was allowed to sell the gun without a background check or a waiting period. An ID check would be the only thing required in a cash deal. An ATF agent assigned to the ICE team was dispatched to Littleton, Colorado, to interview Dell and show him a photo lineup. Dell chose the photo of Hector Moya as the customer he believed had bought the weapon in Nogales. His receipt book credited the sale to a customer named Reynaldo Sante, which happened to be one of the names contained in the numerous false identification packages found in the room where Moya was arrested. Dell proved to be a key witness at the trial, locking Moya to the gun and the phony ID found in his possession. Though Moya claimed the gun and ID were planted by the police, it must have sounded preposterous to the jury. But now, with the knowledge that Glory Days and Trina Trix were informants to the DEA agent heading the ICE team, I didn't think this was preposterous at all. "Hector, I need you to tell me the truth about something. Don't lie, because I think the truth will actually help you."
"Ask me."
"The false ID in the name of Reynaldo Sante. In trial, you said the gun and the ID were planted in the room by the cops. But that wasn't true, was it?" Moya thought a little bit before answering. He first nodded his head.
"The ID was mine, not the gun."
I nodded. "I thought so." "And you used that ID on previous trips to Los Angeles, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"Those trips, when you were checking into hotels under the name Reynaldo Sante, did you also meet Glory Days and Trina Trix in your rooms?"
"Yes."
I wrote a few notes down. My adrenaline was kicking in my bloodstream. I was clearly seeing a path in which to take the Lacoste case, as well as Moya's. I was on the road to finding something out. "Okay," I said. "Hector, this is all good so far. I think we can do something with this."
"What else do you want to know?"
"For the moment, nothing, but I'll be back to see you. The main thing I wanted today was your cooperation and to know we could work together. I'm going to need you to testify at my other client's trial. We will build a record in that trial that will support your habeas petition. One case will help the other. You understand?"
"I understand."
"And testifying is not a problem? Your people will understand what you're doing?"
"I will make them understand."
"Then we're good here. The last thing I want to mention is a word of advice on Silvestre Fulgoni."
"Silvestre, yes."
"Silvestre, then. He was a very good lawyer, but he is not a lawyer anymore. so you have to remember that anything you tell him is not protected like it is with anything you tell me. Be circumspect with what you say to him, understand? Be careful. He nodded. Okay, and speaking of which, to make things all legal between you and me, you need to sign an authorization that allows me to represent you. I had the document ready to go, folded lengthwise in my inside pocket. I slipped it and a pen across the table to him, and he signed it. Okay, then. I think we're finished here, I said. Stay safe, Hector. And you too, Miguel. Chapter 28. Once in the Lincoln again, I told Earl he could take us back to the city.
How'd it go in there, boss?
You know, Earl, I've visited a lot of different people in a lot of different prisons, and I'm not sure if I've ever had a better visit.
That's good.
Yeah, real good. I opened the contacts file on my phone and scrolled down to the V's. I might not have had Fernando Valenzuela on speed dial anymore, but I knew I still had his cell on my contacts list. I made the call and wondered if he'd answer when my name came up on the screen. I was about to hang up before it went to message when he finally picked up.
Yo, Mick, don't tell me you're calling me with all of this work you promised me.
As a matter of fact, Val, I thought you should know that I've partnered up with Falcone, so it looks like we'll be working together again after all.
Ain't that a shame? I'll believe it when I hear it from Falcone, not you.
That's fine. You call him. But there's something I need from you right now.
Of course there is. But I'm not falling for this shit, Holler. I'll call Falcone, and if he clears it, then I'll see what you need.
You can do whatever you want, Val. But I need you to text me the photo you took of Giselle Dallinger when you papered her back in November. You got that? Giselle Dallinger. If I don't get it in the next 10 minutes, you're fired.
We'll see what Sly says about that.
Sly and his old man are working for me. I don't work for them. You've got 9 minutes now, Val. I disconnected the call. Something about Valenzuela always got under my skin. He always acted like he knew something I didn't, like he had something on me.
That true? Earl asked from the front seat. You and Falcone partnering up?
Just on one case, Earl. That's about all I could take with those guys. Earl nodded. I looked around and saw that he had us back on the 15 freeway heading south. Traffic was sparse, and it gave me hope that we might get into L.A. before the afternoon traffic crunch. That would allow me to keep rolling with the momentum the prison visit had brought. I called Cisco to once again redirect his activities. I'm going to need you to go to Colorado.
What's in Colorado?
A guy named Bud Wendell. He was a witness against Moya at his trial. He's an unlicensed gun dealer from Littleton who testified that he sold the gun to Hector Moya at a gun show in Nogales. I think he lied. I think somebody from the ICE team maybe put him up to it. The ATF probably had something on him. I want you to go talk to him and see if he's going to hold up when I get him on the stand.
I'm working 5 different things here, Mick. You want me to drop it all and catch a plane?
Sometimes momentum can move you too far too quickly. Cisco had a good point. I want you to go when the time is right, but I think this guy's going to be key.
Okay, I'll get out there by the end of the week. But first I'll make sure he's in Colorado. If he's still on the gun show circuit, he might be anywhere. They're all the rage these days.
Good point. I'll leave it in your hands then. You know what to do.
Okay, what else you got up there?
Sly Falcone Jr. subpoenaed Gloria a week before she was murdered. I think that's what triggered the whole thing. They killed her before she could talk. Cisco whistled. He did that whenever a piece of the puzzle fell into place.
There was no subpoena found in her place. I studied the inventory.
Because they took it. That's why she was killed in her home. They had to find the subpoena or the locals might ask questions.
How did they know?
Falcone filed it under seal, so I'm thinking Gloria told the wrong person about it.
Marco?
That's who I'm guessing. But I don't want to guess. I want to nail it down.
Phone records.
If there are any.
Lacoste said he and Gloria used burners that they changed all the time.
I'll see what I can find. You might have to ask a judge from Marco's records and we'll try to match her numbers from the burners.
That'll be a fight to the finish.
What else did you get up there, Mick? Sounds like a good trip.
Yeah, well, I think I got our case. We just need to nail down this guy Bud Wendell and a few other things.
Prompted by thinking about the fight that would ensue if I sought Marco's phone records, I was suddenly struck by where the case's true battle would most likely be.
It's going to be a subpoena case, I said. Getting these people into court, Dell, Marco, Langford, none of them are going to willingly testify. Their agencies will fight it tooth and nail. The feds will even fight my putting Moya on the stand. They'll cite public safety, the cost to taxpayers, anything to prevent him from being brought down to L.A. to testify.
They might have a point on the public safety angle, Sisko said. Moving a cartel guy? This could be Moya's whole plan, to get moved out into the open so his people can make a run at grabbing him. A lot of space between L.A. and Victorville.
I thought about Moya and the conversation we just had.
Could be, I said. But something tells me that's not the case. He wants out, fair and square. If he wins his habeas, he'll probably walk on time served. He's already been in 8 years on 2 ounces. The only thing holding him is the gun enhancement.
Well, either way, Sisko said, you're going to need a strong judge, one who will stand up.
Yeah, not many of those left.
It was true. Many judges were already fronts for the state. But even those who weren't would be hard-pressed to allow me to present the defense I was envisioning. The true battleground of the case would be in the hearings, before a single juror was seated. Unless I came up with another strategy to get my witnesses in, I decided not to think about it for now.
So how are you making out? I asked.
I'm getting close to connecting Langford and Marco, Sisko said. That was good news. Tell me about it.
It's a little tentative now, so give me a day on it. It involves a double murder in Glendale, a drug ripoff going back 10 years. I'm waiting on records. It's a cold case, so not a problem getting the docs.
Let me know when you know. You heard from Bullocks today?
Not today.
Hey, boss! Earl said from the front seat. I looked at his eyes in the mirror. They weren't on me. They were on something behind us. Something that was scaring him.
What is...
The impact was loud and hard, as something with what felt like the power of a train plowed into us from behind. I was belted in, but even so, my body was hurled forward into the fold-down tabletop affixed to the back of the seat in front of me, and then thrown against the door as the Lincoln went into a sideways slide to the right. Fighting the centrifugal force of the slide, I managed to raise my head up enough to look over the right side door sill. I saw the freeway guardrail a microsecond before we hit it, flush, and our momentum took us over it. The car started tumbling down a concrete embankment. The crunching of steel and shattering of glass sharpened my ears as it flipped once, then twice, then 3 times. I was whipped around like a rag doll, until the car finally came to a metal-grinding stop, upside down, and at the 45-degree angle of the embankment. I don't know how long I was out, but when I opened my eyes, I realized I was hanging upside down by the seatbelt. An old man on his hands and knees was staring at me through the broken window on the high side of the car.
"Mister, you all right?"
the man said.
"That was a bad one."
I didn't answer. I reached to the seatbelt and pushed the release button without thinking,